Welcome, Ani. We are talking to Nahla Abdo, and I first of all just want to acknowledge that we are on First Nations territory, and I give thanks to my ancestors for protecting us and keeping us here on this land despite the genocidal efforts of the Canadian state to eliminate us. Thank you for, you know, taking the time to be with me right now. There's so much going on, and I'm really looking forward to your insight with the situation in the Middle East right now, the incredible amassing of military troops in the region, the warmongering and the hysteria that's permeating our media. I just really want to ask you what impact this is having on Palestinian people in general and on women in particular.
Thank you, Audrey, for this question, and I wish women all over the world a peaceful, actually, year and a more active role in turning this crazy world into a more peaceful world, a more livable world for all of us, and especially for the next generation. And this is more poignant, actually, for people like yours and mine, for Aboriginals here in Canada, as well as Indigenous Palestinians in Palestine and in Israel. I would like to say that, you know, the hysteria of war and militarization and pumping billions of dollars into destruction rather than into any constructive idea is actually devastating for the world in general, but also devastating for women in particular. As you know, women all over the world bear actually the primary brunt of the war, of the devastation of wars and destruction, whether it is right now actually in Iraq or in any other part of the world. The impact of hysteria, which is not just permeating our media, but it also, unfortunately, is permeating, you know, the empire, basically, and the rulers within that American empire, with totally relentless efforts, although based largely on, you know, all kinds of fakes and lies, but it, you know, for them, it doesn't really matter. The point for them is just to reshape, or in the world of Rumsfeld, basically to remodel the Middle East in the interest of America. That remodeling is going to have devastating impact on the whole peoples of the Arab Middle East, actually, not just the Iraqis, but Iraqis and the rest of the Arab world, the rest of the Middle East. And turning, you know, the whole area more dependent on America. The impact on Palestinians is going to be equally devastating, because Palestinians actually have been under the direct aggression, not just of America, but more closely of Israel, of the colonial settler state of Israel. Palestinians are actually suffering every single day deaths. You know, you have between 5 and 11 people killed every damn day by Israeli weapons, which are largely American weapons. And very little has been done internationally around these issues. Women, more specifically, are being, you know, Palestinian women are being also bearing the brunt of, you know, partly being killed while they're in their homes, partly being devastated economically, unable to, you know, to survive. Unemployment rate in Palestine is just staggering. Poverty is also staggering. Their political situation is, you know, is one of oppression and repression on a daily basis. And women are, you know, also suffering from losses of their loved ones, their children, their men, their fathers, their, you know, their members of their family, their friends, their neighbors. They are living under, you probably have heard, you know, all kinds of closures. They're living under immobility of movement. This is the International Women's Day, actually, where women in the West are celebrating not these trivial things like, you know, right to movement, and right to food, right to, you know, right to shelter, but they're celebrating more of, you know, of ideas, of alliances, of solidarity, of all sorts of things that at this point seem to be a bit of not just auxiliary, but rather luxury mm-hmm. for Palestinian women who are at this point actually, you know, undergoing tremendous difficulties, unable to move from, you know, their villages to other villages, being under, you know, total military control and military devastation by the Israeli state. Now, a war on Iraq is going to have, you know, further ramifications on Palestinians, because, you know, the kind of alliance which is between Israel and, or the Holy Alliance, let's put it this way, between Israel and the Americans, is, you know, has basically one long-term goal, namely sharing, you know, the gains and the interests of that part of the world. So now with the re-election of Sharon, the war criminal Sharon, I mean, just the fact that Sharon is ruling, but right now ruling with more right-wing, if anyone can imagine what could be more, you know, a more right-wing than Sharon himself. And, you know, in his coalition campaign, mm-hmm. he just announced very clearly that, you know, there would be no negotiations over Jerusalem, as Jerusalem is going to be, you know, the so-called eternal capital of Israel, and there would be more settlers. It's not surprising that he made the, you know, Netanyahu, the minister mm-hmm. of, made him as a minister, not of foreign affairs as usual, but made him as, you know, as a minister of finances, because he made economic conditions or the economic situation, including bringing settlers, which demands actually a lot of money, you know, the most important priority for him. So more settlers means, you know, less land. Less land means less sovereignty. Less sovereignty means more restrictions on Palestinians in general and women in particular. So I'm sorry to say that the situation is very grim right now for Palestinians in general and women in particular. This is if we just consider the, you know, the external conditions and the ramifications of the current war and, you know, its impact on the region, particularly on Palestinians.
I'm always amazed at the, despite the lack of those luxuries that you were mentioning earlier that we have in the West and that we sometimes take for granted, people find ways to resist and they find those pockets where they can, you know, act and organize. And it's been a very long time since personally I traveled to the region. I was there during the first Intifada, which was quite a different time, and where I believe women were a driving force and very much the backbone of that movement of civil disobedience. And I'm just wondering what is going on now in terms of finding ways to resist and survive.
So two things, I believe, are you know, in place here. On the one hand, yes, I mean, throughout history, if we go back to history, there is no doubt that all people that have suffered colonialism and settler colonialism, including, you know, our aboriginals here in Canada, and Palestinians, and Algerians, and South Africans, and etc., these people, you know, have never been passive, you know, being women or men. They were never silent, despite, you know, the aggression, despite the devastation, despite, you know, all attempts at, you know, even genocidal attempts mm-hmm. in both cases. Women have always taken, you know, a major part in reaffirming their national rights, their collective rights, their rights as a people, not just rights as women. And you know, working to resist existing forms of oppression, working towards building, you know, their civil society, and a civil society that is, you know, that is progressive, a civil society that guarantees not just, you know, their independent sovereignty and sovereignty as a group, as a community, as a collectivity, but also as women, you know, having to launch their own fights as well as, you know, on the gender basis, mm-hmm. not just, you know, on the political, economic, social, etc. basis. So, in general, women, you know, throughout have always taken part in resisting settler colonialism and resisting different forms of oppression. As for Palestinian women, you have rightly actually pointed out that there is a difference actually between the role women assumed during the First Intifada and the role Palestinian women currently are assuming during the Second Intifada. In the late, in 1987, with the start of the First Intifada, women were heavily involved in not just civil disobedience, but I think at all fronts, actually. They were part of the leadership, you know, underground, if you want, leadership. They were part of, they took a major part in rebuilding their own civil society and, you know, educating kids despite closures of universities and of schools. They built, you know, makeshift schools in homes. They went and, you know, educated people in homes and you know, re-established, if you want, that part of civil society. They built sort of local, domestic type of economy. And they called them economies of independence rather than being economically dependent on Israel. You know, they pickled stuff, they sewed stuff, they created all kinds of, you know, products in their homes as means of, you know, self-sufficiency and dissociating themselves from, you know, from the occupiers. On, you know, in addition to that, they took a major active role in resistance itself. I mean, they were stone throwers, but at the same time, civil society builders, you know, in the same time. And they were out in the streets in masses, especially the first year, actually, of the Intifada, before other changes have, you know, have taken place there. And, you know, if you remember, actually, that Intifada, you know, as despite the fact that it resulted in the you know, killing of thousands of Palestinians, still the kind of resistance at the time made it possible for women to achieve a lot of changes at various levels, including the social gender level as well. Now, remember, 87, 89, 90, actually, Palestinians were working without a state. They were, you know, there was no state per se, or half a state, or whatever that is. There was no order. There were no laws. There was no sort of legislature. There was nothing actually in terms of, you know, institutions of civil society. Now that was built, although built in a problematic way, you know, since Oslo 1994 up till, you know, the Second Intifada. Now in the year 2000, with the Second Intifada, all of the conditions under which Palestinians, men and women, were struggling before have, in some sense, disappeared, and women found themselves in a different situation. On the one hand, a large part of, you know, of the killing and confrontation, if you want, were happening around, if you want, points of contact between Palestinians and the Israeli soldiers around the checkpoint. In other words, totally removed from, you know, from the home front, from the community front, from, you know, the inside of the village and inside of the town. So, you know, this is why we see, or we have been seeing in this particular intifada, that more males, more men and young men were taking part, much more actually than women in that sense. Plus, you know, during the last, you know, I mean, since then, during the last 6 years, if you want, between 94 and 2000, there have been attempts at institutionalizing different, you know, women's activities through universities, through ministries, through institutions. And that also has taken away from sort of, you know, the sense of building a civil society without a structure. So there was some sort of a structure there, you know, in this second intifada. But also this second intifada, I mean, you know, Israelis were, you know, hysteric. And the second intifada was under a war criminal, Sharon, who, you know, cared less about not just, you know, Palestinians, definitely never cared about Palestinians, but cared less about the whole international community. And, you know, would not abide by a single UN resolution, by a single international law. So he, you know, he reigned free, if you want, as a total madman. And the Americans supported him left and right. There was, you know, there was no question there about, you know, pouring more billions of dollars from the American taxpayers into, you know, into his reign, despite the fact that also the international community itself has condemned him as a war criminal. In fact, Israel itself, with the Commission of Inquiry, have found him guilty. In, you know, in the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, the man is, you know, has committed genocide against Palestinians. Still, he was able actually to continue his rule with the most, you know, with an iron fist, worse than, you know, the situation before. So things, I must say, have changed in terms of women's roles and in terms of, you know, their ability to resist. And this is why I think it's extremely important, especially today during, you know, International Women's Day, so it's during International Women's Month, actually, that we see more alliances, not, you know, not just actually among those women who are suffering under settler colonial states, under military occupation, under wars, under devastation, but also, and perhaps more importantly, by, you know, women in the West who, you know, who claim feminism as a movement of liberation, feminism as a movement of self-consciousness, feminism as a movement, you know, of anti-racism, anti-war, etc. You know, we need to find, you know, we need to see more alliances, more solidarity among women internationally. I blame, you know, most especially white Canadian women for their, you know, deafening silence vis-a-vis actually, you know, Aboriginal issues and, you know, all over the world, and vis-a-vis Palestinians. You know, it's quite unfortunate that, you know, we have not yet, as Canadian women, come to grips, actually, with the conditions of women all over the world, particularly women under devastation, like, you know, Palestinian women at this point, as well as, you know, of course, Iraqi women, Afghani women, all these women that are, you know, facing basically the aggression of the Western governments themselves. So that kind of silence, actually, or to a large extent silence, is something that I think we have to bring it out and hold all, you know, forces who are silent about these issues, hold them responsible, because silence equates very much is equitable to not doing anything. Not doing anything is the same as, you know, approving of the oppression against women. So it's, you know, at this point actually in time, I think it is very important for us in living in the West to sort of unify our forces, particularly women's forces of women who are concerned with, you know, world equality, with equality of women, with quality of life of women, that, you know, they get together and take a role, and an active role, you know, against wars, against devastation, against settler colonialism, and against all forms of racism.
You've spoken about, in particular, the role of academics in excluding this issue. And I believe you were involved in a petition that, or some women here in Toronto actually signed a petition where they criticized some of Israel's policies, and they were met with quite a bit of backlash. Is that right?
Right.
Is that something that people hide behind? There seems to be also now in the current anti-war movement a real fear to talk about the Palestinian issue. And there certainly is a lot of equating of critique of Israel with anti-Semitism that is a very useful card in the hands of those who want war.
Yes, actually, anti-war it also implicitly means anti-occupation, means anti-intervention from outside into people's lives. It means anti-Israeli colonialism. It means anti-Israeli occupation. So there is definitely, a line embedded in this anti-war thing, because it means anti-militarization at the same time. And Israel, as we know, is perhaps the most powerful military and nuclear power, in the whole region there. It is perhaps the third largest nuclear power in the world. And as you probably know, if the anti-war people are going to question this whole issue of double standards by the Americans, that is, why Iraq only, why not Israel, of course it means that, they're going to be critiquing Israel. And the Israeli lobby in North America, in the media in particular, Canadian media, such as, at least 13 newspapers in our country that are owned by, the owner of the National Post, that is Israel Asper, who is, a major Zionist supporter of Israel and the Israeli state, and one who is, very much against any criticism of the state of Israel. Of course, it is in his interest and the interest of reporters that, that he perhaps, dictate them what to write there, to basically try to equate any criticism of war and criticism of the state of Israel as anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism can be, this card, as you mentioned earlier, that, is used to silence people, vis-a-vis their, anti-racist, anti-war, anti-aggression policies. And you're right, the anti-war movement are, or some of them actually, I shouldn't really generalize, because if we look at the anti-war movement throughout Europe, and we're talking about millions of people, these people were clear about the issue. And, if you look at the pictures, actually, the pictures show many Palestinian flags, many connection between, between wars all over. What is happening against Palestinians is one-sided war by Israel, by the Israeli state. And that connection for them does not, it does not escape them at all. Because I think they are a little bit freed from that, terrible intimidation of the Zionist lobby in North America. The petition that, yes, I was part of it, that came out of Canadian academics, in which actually reached, by the way, it's not just 70 people, according to some of the, I have to say that it reached over 240 academics all over Canada, in almost every single university and college in Canada, who signed this petition. These people are very strong in condemning, Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. And they, but at the same time, we know that once again, the campaign, the media campaign that, tried to follow some names there and try to, pin them down and even punish them for opening up their mouth, was equally strong, and has tried basically to once again silence these voices. There were threats against academics, threats against universities, threats against individuals, threats even threats of life that were given there And we all are aware of, you know, of Daniel Pipes and his Campus Watch,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, the most racist campaign, which had, you know, had some following here in Canada, particularly, once again, by the, you know, the people of the National Post. And, you know, the National Post is not one paper, by the way, and it's not just national, that is all over Canada, but also the National Post has branches, has 13 other newspapers that disseminate wrong information, fake information, racist information, you know, about Palestinians all over Canada, and equates, you know, any critique of the state of Israel equates it with anti-Semitism, once again as a campaign to silence these voices. So these are connected issues, Audrey. These are very connected issues. Anti-war movement, embedded in that anti-war movement also, you know, anti-Israeli atrocities. In that sense, you know, the anti-war activists, you know, cannot be the same people who, you know, who are staunch supporters of the state of Israel or of that kind of racism. But still, I think, you know, we have enough to learn from, you know, enough evidence, by the way, from Europe, which should, you know, give us here in North America, give us a strong indication that, you know, we should not be intimidated by these right-wing forces, by these forces that support aggression and that support, you know, nuclear power in one place, but not nuclear power in, you know, in another place. I mean, if you want to dismantle weapons of mass destruction, let's begin with the United States. And then we move on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then we move on to Israel, and then we move on to, you know, every other country that has the most destructive power is the United States at this point. The United States as a government. We know that, you know, American people at large, and many of them have also, you know, gone to the streets, have taken up the streets because they are against it. They are against, you know, the weapons. Actually, I was reading just a couple of days ago that there were hundreds of thousands of phone calls and
yes.
of emails
yes.
Basically swamping the system.
I want to try and shift a little bit now to talking about what's happening within the Palestinian society.
Yeah.
It's so hard sometimes, I know this from my own experience working in the Aboriginal Women's Action Network, when we face such violence from an outside, in bracket, you know, in quotes, an outside enemy, sometimes to talk about what's going on and what's not,
mm-hmm.
not good about our own struggle,
right.
and issues can be excluded or, you know, completely silenced in the name of some kind of unity, which I often think is a false unity, and which tends to privilege perhaps those who have power within that society. So I'm thinking specifically about intimate violence against women, and I know that you were involved. I know that you have a long history of calling attention to this struggle as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, you're right. It is sometimes it is tough actually to discuss these quote-unquote internal forms of oppression. Or our own patriarchy, our own sort of our own communities type of aggression against women. It is difficult, not, you know, not just because because the community itself, which is, I agree with you, is a false notion, and because it's not really a unitarian or a unit, homogeneous unit at all. It has, you know, built in hierarchies based on gender, on ethnicity, on, you know, all sorts of, on class, on all sorts of things. So it is a false concept altogether as, you know, collectivity or entity. But the problem with, you know, just briefly, the problem with here is that the external pressure sort of seeps in so deep into, you know, into all of the structure of the community that sometimes it blurs, you know, the difference between our own oppression and you know, and the external oppression, and somehow the external oppression becomes more prioritized. I totally understand the situation. However, having said that, it does not mean that, you know, there are no internal local forms of patriarchy and oppression which and violence actually against women in the Palestinian case, like I think in any other community, violence against women has probably has always been there. You know, historically has always been there. But there are various stages where that violence can, you know, can be not just more severe, such as, you know, killing of women, and killing of women as, you know, perhaps the most extreme form of sexual violence, of the killing called, you know, honor killing, stupid form, which is very much patriarchal because it's the honor of the man, the honor of the family.
Mm-hmm.
To you know, to maintain the females in you know, in the household, keep them as hostages, literally, for the man, being him, you know, the father first, and then the husband or the brother or the uncle or etc. So violence against Palestinian women, which once again, let me repeat, has historically been there, I think continues, unfortunately, to be part of the oppression that Palestinian women are facing as women, in this case not just as, you know, as members of a community under occupation, but also you know, as members of Palestinian community from their own community, from the males in their own community. In late 90s I was involved in a major study. And, of course, also the establishment of a gender unit in Gaza, which basically would, you know, sort of equip or teach or train Palestinian refugee women to research their own sort of issues. And one of the issues that, you know, we focused on is the issue of violence against women. And the results, you know, that came out of that research suggested that violence against women, internal violence, let's put it this way, you call it intimate, I don't know what is intimate in it, it's very unintimate, it's very, you know, cruel type of violence, but is happening, you know, from members of the family, and I know you, this is what exactly you meant, members of the family that would kill, you know, women who are even suspected of having defied, you know, the patriarchal norms. By you know, whatever, losing their virginity, having sex relations outside of you know, of the marriage contract, etc. Cases of women who have been abused by members of their families, and cases of women who have been killed by members mm-hmm. of the families. Now are there? Have always been there. Now, we have not been able to establish whether it's on the rise because of, you know, especially now, actually, because of lack of, if you want, rule, lack of order, lack of, you know, any sort of law, lack of incentives, lack of, you know, devastating economic conditions, political conditions, frustration, you know, intimidation, etc. I mean, all of these things have something to do with it, but they are still, you know, internal to this community. We have not established if it is in the rise, you know, if violence mm-hmm. against women is on the rise, or whether it is, you know, being, to tell you the truth, spoken more about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something quite
mm-hmm.
encouraging,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fact that women are coming out
mm-hmm.
and speaking, you know, about it is, I think, a new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not new now, but, you know, it has been, you know, increasingly evident. There is more research done into it. More women, especially, by the way, so-called ordinary women, if you want. These women are not, you know, are not your silent women. They are not your passive women. You know, you sit with them in refugee camps or in villages or anywhere, and they tell you their, you know, their whole stories. No reluctancy whatsoever to even speak about the, you know, the most intimate part of their bodies, and, you know, part of their lives. So there is a lot that is happening, actually, at that front. A lot in the sense that, yes, a lot of violence, but at the same time, more and more women are taking it out and, you know, sort of voicing it in the public and, you know, sharing it with other people and realizing, you know, with other women, and realizing at the same time that the only way they could, you know, change their own situation is by generalizing, you know, the problem and understanding that other women have also faced, you know, similar situations, and, you know, so some sort of hopefully collective act would, you know, would do things in terms of changing these conditions. Here again, Audrey, let me just make this point that I strongly believe that this violence against women, which is often shaded or veiled, if you want, under the term community or collectivity, is something that probably is there in every, you know, ethnic community or national community anywhere in the world. And I think, you know, also in the name of international women, I really hope that at one point there would be enough efforts on the part of women to take up these issues. Of course, contextualize them in each, you know, specific historical context, but at the same time, take up these issues and work in solidarity in support of other women, not from, you know, from a prejudiced or, you know, a racist perspective, as in, you know, for example, Westerners just pointing to violence against women, and let's say among Palestinians, seeing it as you know, in a derogative way, or seeing it as you know, look at these let's say backward people where women are oppressed by their own culture and or religion. I think we don't need this. What we need is a generalized understanding of the situation that is contextualized in each, you know, history among the Aboriginals in Canada, in the States, in Palestine, everywhere else, where, you know, we can really be conducive, you know, to this whole debate, conducive in the sense that we come up with, you know, some practical issues to help women out in these situations. So let's hope that, you know, instead of celebrating, you know, International Women's Day or International Women's Month as you know, a month of achievement, let's look at what we have not yet achieved. Let's look at what is there to be done. There is a lot to be done, you know, in terms of, you know, insofar as women are concerned. And this is one area.
Yeah, you definitely raise an important point that I've experienced in my work with Aboriginal women, the pervasiveness of the racism that on a day-to-day basis that Native people face means that it is taking a huge risk for an Aboriginal woman, say, just to call a crisis center or to go for help or to seek help, because it is so often going to be feeding into those stereotyped ideas that people have about the Native society being a violent society. About, I mean, I've had people ask me if there's more violence in my community because we drink so much, or is it a cultural thing? I mean, I've had people come right out and ask me these questions when, and then this has been a reason for, you know, Native men, leaders in our community, to discourage women from doing this work, because they don't want to see those kind of stereotypes perpetuated. So we find that we are struggling on many different fronts. And those women, as you point out, who are starting to talk about more and more about the violence that they're experiencing, they are taking incredible risks. You know, they're risking, and when we speak about intimate violence, we mean as opposed to stranger violence,
yeah,
people who we've been intimate with and who we may want to continue being intimate with.
Yeah.
You know, so many of the women that we interviewed on reserves in northern BC, why don't they report? Because they so often have the community is already devastated. There is such a huge over-incarceration of Aboriginal people in jails that women are trying to protect their brothers, their sons, their grandfathers, etc., and trying not to feed into that situation, that colonizer situation that we have. So I think it's, you know, it's a real challenge for women like yourself who do decide to do this work and look at those issues, and we really need the solidarity, as you say.
Absolutely. I mean, your intervention is very well taken. I exactly understand what you're saying. Palestinians do not live a different life than Aboriginals here. Aboriginals here face, you know, that sort of Western white settler state. Palestinians exactly face that Western white settler Israeli state. And it's not just the state, unfortunately, but it also translates into, you know, other, if you want, other colluders with the state, such as academia, unfortunately. So you would find in, you know, in whether in conferences or otherwise, if there is an Israeli conference and they want, you know, to invite a Palestinian, often the Palestinian that is invited is that token type of Palestinian who would, you know, talk about their own violence, you know, who would talk about their own, you know, about their own, you know, cultural deficiencies, religious problems. You're saying that, you know, they would blame it on drinking, but they don't ask themselves why, you know, why are we drinking? Why is alcohol, you know, a part of our lives? What kind of miserable situation you put us in, not just, you know, miserable. You took our land, you took our culture, you know, genocide was happening at all fronts. You know, cultural genocide, social, economic, political, land, people, extermination. And something, you know, very similar has been happening in Palestine. And many Israeli academic women, you know, self sort of proclaimed feminists who, you know, can go out to the West and, you know, flaunt their feminism. When it comes to Palestinians living, you know, next door to them, they are very racist about them. You know, they also see them, in eyes of inferiority. They are, you know, they collude with their own state around all of these issues. These are, you know, I've never really seen the situation of Palestinians as very unique, the only kind of situation in the world. I've always tried to see it within the context of, you know, a settler colonial white state, which is very similar to, you know, many Aboriginal people, also similar to, you know, women of color, and also similar to, you know, black women, who have been once again brought as slaves and flaunted as backward people, you know, throughout, and were marginalized. So these are very important issues that I really think women should take up. And this is the, you know, the most I think pertinent, opportune right now, which is International Women's Week, or, you know, or month, or whatever it is, to for women to think and rethink of their position, you know, think and rethink of their racism, and think and rethink of their you know, complex of I'm talking about Western women in particular, Western white women, you know, complex of superiority vis-a-vis the inferiority of the others, the inferiority of, you know, of Aboriginals or of black people or of women of color, etc. So, you know, I see the similarities very much there, and I also see the commonalities, and, you know, also the different forms of resistance within, you know, within, let's say, these communities, resistance to the type of racism that they are, they face every time, you know, when they start opening up their mouths. Because, you know, the minute you admit, and this is very problematic, by the way, I've experienced it also personally, not just in terms of, you know, my research. Once I was invited to a conference held and organized by Israeli feminists. You know, these are academics, supposedly, and, you know, academics, one would think that, you know, they read, you know, mm-hmm. they know the debate, they know the situation, they have, you know, they communicate with the rest of the world. So, you know, I dragged myself from Canada and went there, and, you know, they invited, I mean, we were very tokenized there, although they tried to show that, you know, Palestinians are an important sort of, you know, community within the Israeli. By the way, there is more than 1,200,000 Palestinians who are Israelis, you know, mm-hmm. Israeli citizens. I'm not talking about the West Bank and Gaza right now. I'm not talking about the occupied territories. But these women live in, you know, a constant and consistent form of racism there. So in that conference, when, you know, when they invited me, I started talking about, you know, the meaning of the state that we live in, the meaning of the Israeli state. And you wouldn't believe, you know, how outrageously.
I guess they didn't want you to go there.
Well, I don't know why they invited me altogether in an outrageous manner. One of their colleagues stood up and said, Oh, what are you talking about, the state? This is politics. We are here to discuss women's issues.
It was
devastating for me. What's going on? Where do these people live? Since when the state is not, you know, a primary issue for women?
Yeah.
I mean, if the state is not a primary issue for Aboriginal women, then who is the primary issue? Then who turns Aboriginal people into you know, miserable, marginalized people, nations? Who turned the Palestinians into occupied? Who turned, you know, all of these communities into what they have become? So, you know, for us here in the West, I think, once again, this is another opportune to make the connections between, you know, between the state, make the connections between colonialism and, you know, settler colonialism in particular, women's movement, women's principles. You know, I really, I'm a big sort of fan of seeing one day where, you know, we could get together as women and truly bring out all of the, you know, of the different, if you want, forces or factors that have been shaping and reshaping our lives. And, you know, say it very clearly. Say it, for, you know, for example, for Canadian academics, if you want, you know, where do they stand on all of these issues? Where do they stand on Aboriginal women? Where do they stand on, you know, on genocide? Where do they stand on all of these issues? And there is very little that has been done on this. I think, you know, that the Western feminist movement, unfortunately, especially now, you know, going on and on and on with its, you know, involvement in conceptual work and in postmodernism at a time where very sort of primary issues of survival for so many women all over the world have not yet been discussed. So there, we have a lot of work actually to do as women. We have a lot of things to sort of achieve if we want to see, you know, a life of women that is free of oppression, that is free of violence, that is free of exploitation and of, you know, devastation.
Thank you very much. As we wrap up, I'm just wondering if there's anything you want to add. We are this particular interview will wrap up a week of programming. I hope that our listeners, in particular those women that you mentioned earlier, are going to, you know, take this to heart and do some thinking and engage with us. I look forward, you know, to continuing building alliances, in particular among our Aboriginal communities, but also with those women who are our allies and, you know, who we need in order to move forward.
Basically put my voice together with yours, and I share, you know, all of your concerns, and I also hope and wish that, you know, we use this opportunity and, you know, to build much better and stronger, actually, alliances among women all over. Women within, as you said earlier, within our own communities, but definitely also women within which we also live. But because remember, I mean, in Canada, it is true that, you know, let's say Palestinians live with, you know, their own community, Arab community, but they more so, or perhaps the same, at the same time, they also live among, you know, among other Canadians. Similarly with, you know, with Aboriginal people, they have their own communities, their own concerns, and their own, you know, nations to build and establish, but at the same time, they live among other communities as well. So I hope that there would be, you know, much better solidarity among women all over. And I thank you very much, Audrey, for this interview.
I thank you, Meg Wetch, to you, and all the best to you and your family.
Thank you very much.